Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people. A regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics. Brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Park.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red Podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California today. Bob is off on assignment, so you got me today. But we're talking about, one of the topics in which I, do a lot of work in and like to talk about, which is climate and the climate movement. And joining me to talk about that today is Professor Dana Fisher, who's a professor in the School of International Service at American University. She's also an author of numerous books, including her newest book, which is Saving Ourselves from Climate Shocks to Climate Action, which is also featured prominently in her background there. Welcome to the Green and Red Podcast, Dana.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Yeah. And so you've written a book, which is a lot about the climate movement and about the sort of last five, six years, I would say, of what's happened around climate and climate policy and the climate movement. And so maybe just to kind of dive in, we've also seen a lot of, what you call climate shocks. We're starting to see the climate unravel. We're seeing, wildfires and floods and droughts and things like that. My first question is how do you see the shocks from catastrophic climate change fueling this climate movement, which we've seen with such vigor in the last half decade or more?
Yeah, I mean, we actually are currently in a moment of what I would call somewhat of the movement abeyance, which means that we're seeing less mobilized activists than we were during the period of the Trump administration, which is standard because historically in the United States, left-leaning activists and movements, which are the ones that tend to be more engaged in tactics out in the streets, do not mobilize as effectively or in as large numbers during a Democratic administration. So we're seeing basically in a lot of ways very classic patterns. We also happen to have the intervening pattern of everybody's response to January 6th, which was basically, a movement that was fueled by the president of the United States at the time, which, aimed to inflict violence on elected officials who were not supporting his claims about the election. So lots of people, there was lots of activism that was scheduled around the inauguration that all got canceled. And we have that along with the natural processes, the natural patterns that we tend to see when a new administration takes office. So we've seen many fewer people in the streets than we did during the Trump administration. And my last book, which was called American Resistance, was all about the mobilization, not just for climate, but around all sorts of left-leaning issues, the coalition that formed to push against the Trump administration's policies. So just worth noting there. So with regard to climate activism, though, we are seeing more and more people now mobilizing. And we're seeing the movement shifting quite a bit. And some of that is in response to climate shocks, like you were talking about. One of the things I think is interesting is, so one of the ways that I collect my data is I survey protesters at marches, demonstrations, et cetera. And I've been doing that since the first time I ever did that was at the COP6 negotiations in 2000 in The Hague. And I've been doing it ever since. I have many different types of protests around many different issues, but lots of them have been climate related. So I actually was at the March to End Fossil Fuels last September, which took place before the UN meeting in New York City. Right. 75,000 people were there in the streets. It was the largest climate mobilization since Biden took office. It also happened to be, the largest one since January 6th, because we've seen these smaller performative actions, but not large-scale protests since January 6th around, well, not until now, but certainly not around climate. Anyway, one of the things that I did for that protest is I actually added some questions to my survey instrument. One of the questions that I asked was a question that said, in the past 6 months, have you personally experienced any of the following? And then I listed all of the things that we define as climate shocks, which are basically extreme patterns that are exacerbated by climate change that are well documented in the literature. And so I have, wildfire, smoke from wildfire, flooding, sea level rise, extreme flooding, sea level rise, extreme heat, extreme weather events. You know, so there's this list, but I don't specifically call them climate shocks because I wanted to give people a chance to just say, what did they experience in the past 6 months? And 86% of the people in the crowd said they had experienced wildfire or smoke from wildfire, which makes sense. As you know, summer 2023 was the summer of the Canadian wildfires that hit basically a huge swath of the United States. New York City, well, Washington, D.C., we had it too. My kids weren't allowed to play recess, right, and outdoor sporting events got canceled. But it was actually a whole bunch of states that were affected by it. But New York City had those amazing images. Y'all have those images out west too sometimes, but not last summer, right?
No, we had them often. We've had them often though.
Right, exactly. I mean, so 86% of the people in the crowd, over 80% also said they had experienced extreme heat. Over 30% said they had experienced extreme flooding or sea level rise, which was surprising to me because last fall we had these big storms that flooded out the New York City subway. And there were those amazing images of people canoeing down like Main Street, like main parts of Brooklyn. But this was before that. So people who were in the streets were there in part because they had personally experienced climate change and these climate shocks. And one of the other questions I asked, which might be useful just to wrap up my response, my very long response to this question, is I asked people the emotions they were feeling around the climate crisis, because there's been a lot of discussion about feeling climate doom, climate anxiety, et cetera. And that certainly, a lot of people are feeling that. Yeah. The people who were mobilized consistently reported, most of them reported that they were feeling sadness and anger.
Right.
And I think that there's a very clear connection between the experience of personally experiencing the effects of climate change, getting angry, and mobilizing. So we're going to see more and more of that. And so I think that I know that there's a lot of mobilization scheduled for the summer. We're going to see a long, hot summer for sure. It's already hot here in DC really early. And at the same time, we're going to see a lot of civil disobedience, a lot of activism this summer related to that. So that's what we're seeing now.
Definitely. The climate grief resonates with me. I do. My day job is I work at an environmental nonprofit and do organizing. So climate grief is actually a you know, top of mind topic. But on the anger bit, you know, part of what a lot of advocacy groups is sort of try to direct that at decision makers, whether it's corporate leaders or politicians or what have you. Was there anything in your study that sort of talked about who are you angry at or who is this directed at?
We didn't ask that. That would be a great question to add, but we didn't actually ask that question. So I can't answer that for you. I can tell you that you know, the march was the march to end fossil fuels, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was very clearly, if you believe the slogans and the signs and what people were chanting, no question they were targeting anger at the fossil fuel industry broadly defined, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I was there. I was actually there with my family as well.
Oh, very cool. Did you get surveyed?
I did not.
Okay.
I was also there. Part of my day job is I actually, and we actually did a show on this back in September from Brooklyn. But like I was also there for the week before with the waves of actions where there was a lot of nonviolent direct action targeting banks and insurance companies and asset managers and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And there was a big event down at the Fed right after that. So I was
yes,
there for that too. And I would, yeah. So, yep.
My other question is, since, you know, you said you've been doing this since the COP at The Hague in 2000, for your study, has it mostly been at protests in the US or has there also been in Europe or other parts of the world?
You mean, have I collected data in other parts of the world?
Yeah.
I've collected data in the United States, in Canada, in France, in The Hague, in Germany. I worked with a team once to collect data in the global south that wasn't as effective, and we mostly focus on places where there are peaceful protests. Collected data at the climate negotiations in 2009 in Copenhagen, so at the big march there. So I've collected data, and I've written a bunch on international protest mobilization. Most mm-hmm. of the international stuff I've done, I mean, I did some surveying in Paris. So basically, one of my main areas of research is democracy, protests, and activism. Mm-hmm. And I've done it about all sorts of issues. So I studied the labor laws in France and responses to economic globalization. A lot of my early work was around globalization as well as climate. So yeah, so I've done it all over, but most of it is in the global north.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly I do it in places where it is legal to assemble, because otherwise there is a very different way of doing the research. And also the risks associated with the protests is very different.
Has there been much of a difference in the what the results are, like what you're finding between like other parts of the global north versus the United States?
Not around climate, no.
Okay. Has there been, I'm just curiosity, I mean, has it been around some of the democracy issues or the neoliberalism issues?
I have to say, like, I have to review that. I haven't collected data internationally around other issues in a while. I mean, what I would say is that, I mean, historically, as I talk about in the book, originally climate activism started as targeting the international regime. And so there were coalitions of groups that were working together and coalescing around the Climate Action Network to target and specifically kind of frame the grievances, as well as organize people from around the world that would come out wherever the climate negotiations were taking place, go in the street in a coalition and bring in local sympathizers to working unions, and other local groups would be in the streets as well. But there we saw very similar patterns, but that's a really specific kind of activism targeting international institutions, right? In this case, international institution of the international climate regime. But I also collected data that was for events that were international, that were targeting the World Bank, IMF, the World Economic Forum. And again, we see similar patterns, but in a lot of ways, the groups that are organizing there are targeting a specific type of globalization in terms of like internationalization of policymaking or internationalization of economic policies. In either cases, there were very consistent patterns there, but if we were looking, I mean, I haven't collected data on specific localized issues, except for when I was doing my sabbatical in France and I studied the CEPE, which was the youth labor law. And that was specifically a youth policy. And I would, with regard to that one, which was a specific policy in France, I'd have to go back and look at the data, but that's from early on. So sorry.
No, it's all good. I was just curious. I was also part of the anti-corporate globalization movement. So in your book, you also talk a lot about the radical flank of the climate movement. Very much talk about it in terms of tactics like soup throwing, crazy glue, traffic blocking, things like that. And then there's this component of the climate movement, which is targeting corporations, corporate capitalism, you know, root causes sort of thing. And I'm kind of curious where you found this sort of activism, direct action, protest, that sort of thing, falling into this spectrum, which is, seems to me there's a strategic element there, which I don't feel like comes through as much with like just throwing, you know, a can of Campbell's soup on a piece of art.
I'm not sure what spectrum you're talking about. So in the book, what I specifically do is I talk to the leaders of top groups that were involved in coalitions around mobilizing at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which was originally organized last year, which was organized by Climate Defiance, as well as top organizations that were named as doing more direct action and being a part of the radical flank through open-ended, semi-structured interviews with leaders of various environmental groups. So I ended up doing interviews with many of them, and I didn't just talk about soup throwing. I talked about bird dogging, slow marching, blockading, et cetera, numerous tactics. Now, it happens to be that when I was finishing up the book, there was a lot of attention to people throwing food and these performative actions, but also disruptive actions, like, for example, Extinction Rebellions. This was before their disrupting of, you know, the play, but they were the ones who did the disruption at the U.S. Open last summer, for example. And so what we really are seeing is, if you look at the proportion of climate activism that's happening now, we're seeing more of it being confrontational, more of it using nonviolent civil disobedience. And what I do in the book is I interview these activists, and then I also have run surveys with some of the big groups that are engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience around climate activism to look at the radical flank particularly. And what I do is I disaggregate the different ways that the radical flank works, which people historically don't do when they study the radical flank. And here I talk about the climate, you know, focused radical flank using kind of an air quotes, because I don't believe that what's going on so far within the movement is particularly radical. In fact, if you compare to historical examples, like I talk about in the book, if you look at the struggle for women's suffrage, which involved during the height, you know, the heyday of the movement, they were blowing up a building a month, right?
Right.
Or if you look at the riots that actually were part of the civil rights movement at the end of the cycle of protests there. Anyway, all that being said, what I specifically focus on in the book is looking at these groups that are doing what I call them shockers. And these are the groups that are basically aiming to get media attention through these performative acts. And that's where the soup throwing comes. That's where the paint tossing comes. That's where the sprinkling of the dust, which is, I think, dry paint. That's where crazy gluing comes. And those are groups, most of those groups are specifically aiming, and when you talk to them, they're aiming to get media attention with the idea that talking more about the climate crisis in the media and getting attention for it will help to draw broader attention in the general public and will expand the movement, which is very classic radical flank, because a radical flank works by pushing the discourse, pushing the tactics more in to the left, and also expanding opportunities and changing and shifting the Overton window as well, right? And so anyway, that's part of the radical flank. But I also talk quite a bit in the book about those folks that I call disruptors. And disruptors are folks who use nonviolent civil disobedience as a tactic within a broader, what we call cycle of contention or a broader campaign, right? And there we're talking about the folks who have been engaged in divestment, Third Act. There are numerous religiously oriented groups and many other kind of more locally embedded groups that are running campaigns to target fossil fuel expansion and investment of banks, or targeting other actions. We have right now, like Extinction Rebellion here in DC is targeting the government to try to shift away from new builds having natural gas in them, right? So they basically have a campaign where they work as insiders, they work through advocacy, they work through consumer behaviors and changing consumer behaviors. And then for moments, they engage in civil disobedience as a way of getting attention by using press coverage and media coverage to draw attention to the broader campaigns. Sunrise also does this. So basically, I talk about those distinctions. So I don't really talk about a spectrum there, but rather talk about the broad components of what makes up the radical flank, which has not been done before, and we tend to homogenize what's in there. And the whole argument and the whole point of what I do in the book is basically to make it clear that when we look at the radical flank, it's not all about throwing soup at all.
Right. And that's a little bit what you just explained was what I was trying to get at when I said spectrum, is that the sort of like corporate campaign component, where we're going at, you know, the financing or the insuring of fossil fuel projects or things like that. One other question I'd like to ask about is, you know, we have a number of these what I call backcountry campaigns, like being very disruptive on like pipeline construction. Like I think about Line 3 and I think about the Mountain Valley Pipeline. And I'm wondering if you could actually, you know, talk about that as well, about like Third Act groups have actually been involved at the Mountain Valley Pipeline.
And Scientist Rebellion, a number of the people whom I spoke for the book were involved in Mountain Valley Pipeline and had been involved in other pipeline protests before. And obviously I spoke to Bill McKibben as well, who organized some of the first civil disobedience that marched on Washington around pipelines as well. So, I mean, I think that what's really interesting is that pipeline protests originally started out and were kind of driven by indigenous movements, right? Which were much more environmental justice focused than, you know, broad mainstream climate movement. And in a lot of ways, they set a precedent and opened up the door for a lot of other movements and a lot of other groups to start to think about using civil disobedience in new ways and targeting infrastructure. We see today lots of groups that are targeting infrastructure. I mean, particularly right now, I think the biggest ones are probably around Mountain Valley Pipeline. You might know better than me, but in those cases, we see activists who, and groups that actually, some of them are again, aiming to use moments to disrupt, to draw attention to Mountain Valley Pipeline, the way it's being funded, the way that it was embedded in like a negotiated deal around the IRA. And then there are other folks who are using kind of performance to try to target and shut down, you know, pipelines more broadly. We also do see, and I don't talk about this at all really in the book, but I talk about it a little bit in the book. I talk about it a lot more in my other work, but the way that some young people have really been leaning into using technology and technology facilitated campaigns, particularly on TikTok, to try to stop fossil fuel infrastructure expansion. I do talk a little bit about the failure of the campaign against the Willow Project and how lots of young people who were, you know, leaning into technology as their main way of doing activism felt really burned by the whole experience.
Yeah. And, you know, just thinking about the Mountain Valley Pipeline, an element definitely is this sort of performative, get media attention. But then there's also this element of what I would say is like disruption. It's like if they can disrupt the construction of it so many days and cost the company so much money, which is a sort of like classic, you know, it's kind of probably more out of like anarchist direct action organizing, but like as disruptive as they can be to the sort of like bottom line of a company is like is a piece to that as well. And then the other infrastructure area where I think we're starting to see a lot more is around the build out of like gas, LNG, liquefied natural gas export on the Gulf Coast. That's definitely becoming like, I see that much more in the sort of zeitgeist of
well, I actually think that also there's also been a lot of movement around building out and expanding airfields.
Yep.
And we see action there too. Yeah. I mean, so for sure. And I mean, certainly on the Gulf Coast, there are opportunities to connect again with communities of color, frontline communities, many of whom have felt really burned by celebrations by organizations on the left after the LNG pause, when there's continues to suffer and there's continuing to be a lot of really bad effects to fossil fuel extraction that's taking place now. We're not talking about the future stuff, which has been paused for the moment. So I think there are really great opportunities to do a lot of more bridge building and identity connection and intersectional activism, but we're not seeing as much of that. And as I talk about in the book, we're just not seeing that yet.
Yeah, and there's a long history of the kind of green groups doing that in I think mostly about Louisiana and Texas, like even before climate was the issue, it's around like pollution and, you know, poisoning of communities where big greens would parachute in and, you know, do something and then like claim victory and pull out while the communities were still suffering.
Yep, for sure. I mean, the only other thing I would just say is that when we talk about pipelines, one of the things that I talk about in the book and that I end with is the ways that we need to start thinking more about community and solidarity within the movement. And one of the things that was really clear when I spoke to union leaders was the ways that they felt, I mean, they have historically been on the other side of the pipeline battles, right? And that has been really challenging for thinking about how to connect into labor. And one of the things that I know some groups have been doing, and they started doing much more this past fall after my book was already done, was starting to try to work with unions to try to create more opportunities for, you know, the clean energy transition also to stretch down to workers. I mean, and there are also these initiatives coming. I mean, this is not in the book, but there are also these new initiatives coming from the Department of Energy to help to support the specifically, you know, energy dependent communities through like thinking about energy justice and the Justice 40 initiative. But again, that's not my book, but stuff that I've been doing more recently.
Just like touching on that, although I don't necessarily, I mean, labor, moderate, maybe not moderate, it's definitely had a resurgence lately. Do you think this type of action, some of the action that we've been talking about, everything that we've talked about so far, do you think it's turning off moderate wings of the climate movement or other movements like the labor movement?
Absolutely not. Well, I'm going to put labor in its own box for a second, because I mean, labor has historically not been sympathetic to the climate movement, because they're fighting for, you know, basically the climate movement has been targeting things that they consider to be well-paying jobs in their communities. So labor is a little different. Generally, if we think about these kinds of more, the more radical flank type tactics within the climate movement, there have been lots of claims about how the radical flank and civil disobedience, when it's nonviolent, could turn off lots of people in the movement or turn off people to the climate movement. And there's absolutely no evidence of that, for the record. And in fact, at that same survey that I did at the March to End Fossil Fuels back in September of last year, I actually decided to add a question on that because so many people who don't actually have data were making these claims about it. So I thought, let's go ask the people in the streets, right? So the first thing I do is I always ask about the types of civic engagement that people in the streets have participated in the past year. So I knew that less than half of the people in the streets reported having participated in nonviolent civil or direct action of any sort. So it didn't have to be nonviolent. But only 46% of the people in the crowd had participated in civil disobedience the past year. Okay. So this is not, this was not a crowd of people who were part of the radical flank. It was less than half of them. Then the next question I asked them is, do organizations, the question was, do you support organizations that engage in civil disobedience? For example, and I listed a bunch of stuff, sit-ins, blockades, throwing food, throwing paint, crazy glue, et cetera, and so forth. So everybody knew what I was talking about. And my hope was that the answers to those questions would help us to parse out the patterns about support for the more radical tactics in the movement. But I couldn't do that because not one person in the crowd said that they did not support those tactics. Everybody either supported or strongly supported them. So any argument that people who aren't doing civil disobedience do not support organizations doing civil disobedience is absolutely wrong when you're talking about activists. Now, the question is, will it mobilize sympathizers who are not yet mobilized to be in the movement at all? Well, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence of that. I've been trying to get funding to be able to ask that question and see if, you know, if a pipeline protest versus a, you know, blocking a street versus a soup toss or whatever, if any of those have differential effects on the general public, not people who actually are already mobilized, but are moderates in the movement. But we don't know that. I mean, we have anecdotal evidence that it doesn't seem to matter because, I mean, historically, the radical flank has been defined as and shown to provide support. Basically, it brings out, like, it draws attention to the movement and the cause, and it brings out support for moderate components of the movement. Mm-hmm. That's what it does. That's how it works. And that's been well documented in the civil rights movement. It's documented in the women's movement. It's been documented in all earlier movements. We don't have the right kind of data to document that for people who are not already mobilized, but we should. And I'm sure somebody's going to write that paper if they're not writing it now. But I mean, I just would say, like, there are lots of people with no evidence whatsoever, or there are a couple of people who have run some of these, you know, these internet-based experiments where they say, if a person were to throw soup, you know, and block your traffic, would you like it? You know, I mean, but these are, that is not the way that you do a study to assess how it actually affects people based on their, you know, environmental beliefs and willingness to potentially support moderate flanks of the movement. So we need to ask that in the right way.
I'd be kind of curious, actually, if, you know, for whoever's doing that study, you know, when I think about the civil rights movement and we see lunch counter sit-ins, which is this sort of courageous act, it's a moral act, you know, and it's one that where they received a lot of abuse.
And the, you know, Freedom Riders as well, which
and
also
the Freedom Riders, you know, Mississippi Summer, lots of stuff like that. I'd be kind of curious because there's, you know, I don't necessarily think gluing yourself to something or throwing soup on something is, I would see as the have that sort of like moral level of like what we saw with the lunch counter sit-ins. But there have been climate actions like that. Like when we see actions that happened at Line 3 or Mountain Valley Pipeline.
Dakota Access, right?
Dakota Access Pipeline. I'd be kind of curious if that type of tactic or even those strategies would be something that would move moderates to, you know, move. There's a, in organizing, we use this thing called the spectrum of allies, where you move someone from passively with you to actively with you, which is what they use with Mississippi Summer and Freedom Summer. And so I'd be kind of curious if those have the impact that like throwing soup doesn't.
Well, yeah. So we could do a control study where we actually answer that question. The deal is that at least from the evidence, the limited evidence that exists, throwing soup or, you know, Insulate Britain, there are some data that were done, if you know, the Insulate Britain actions, which were basically blocking traffic in England. Those showed that people supported moderate factions after that. And it was not throwing soup, it was blocking traffic, but, you know, same idea. So but you're completely right. What we really want to do is look at which types of actions and tactics are most effective. Unfortunately, it takes, you know, a structured research would cost a lot of money, not that much money. It certainly doesn't cost anything near what it costs to do climate modeling for, you know, the natural scientists or the atmospheric scientists. But, you know, unfortunately, we don't have those resources to do it. So yeah. We have not done it yet.
I'm just kind of just keeping an eye on our time. I have a couple of other questions just to kind of shift it around a little bit. We always like to talk about popular culture. And so there's like some of this has actually emerged in popular culture. So we have a book and which later became a film on how to blow up a pipeline. We actually interviewed Daniel Goldhaber, the director of How to Blow Up a Pipeline, last year on the show. And many people are familiar, particularly listening to the show, are familiar with Andreas Malm, the academic who, you know, tries to make a case for sabotage and property destruction in the book. The film also, I would actually tries to do that as well. Are you, at least within popular culture, and I also would say within like sort of like real radical, like some seriously radical left of the radical flank movements, we're seeing a tendency towards the tactics. And I think about like Cop City, and I think about, you know, some other spaces. Why do you think we're seeing a tendency for at least a conversation around these tactics, if not seeing these tactics more? And I don't know
in
if there's
pop
any study
culture or in the general
both within pop culture and then also within sort of like these movement spaces.
Pop culture, I think it's coming, but not yet. I mean, I actually am in development for a documentary around my book, so there will be some pop culture there because it will hopefully, you know, if we are successful in developing and getting it made, it will be there. But it's very hard to make climate-focused films right now, even though lots of people say it's needed. So that's my pop culture comment. With regard to these kinds of tactics, I mean, so we're going to certainly see a lot of nonviolent civil disobedience, as much as, you know, Malm's book, but more the film specifically talk about and discuss property destruction. We have not seen a lot of evidence. There's not a lot of evidence that the climate movement has a taste for property destruction or getting more violent. And I still think that's a good thing, especially given the repression that we are at risk of, or that the climate activists are at risk of. So I actually think that the most likely place where we're going to see violence is actually coming from law enforcement and coming from counter movements, which I think will absolutely be in the streets starting to push back, maybe even this summer, if not in the not too distant future.
I mean, kind of happening now in a way to movements.
Oh, no, it's definitely happening now. It's just not happening. It's absolutely happening now. It's just not happening around climate. And granted, yeah, a lot of climate groups that I know are in solidarity out in the streets with these folks on campuses, but that's not like a climate focused, you know, crackdown.
Yes. I have a question for that later, but we can get to that in a minute. Okay. That was like my wrap up question. My other question I kind of wanted to hit on is around the Biden administration on climate. Do you think, you've actually talked a little bit already about what happened with climate movements when Biden took office. Do you see the level of activism and what has been happening having any sort of impact on the Biden administration? Like how have they sort of like moved on this issue? I mean, obviously it's a drastic increase improvement from the Trump administration, but you know, how has sort of climate activism moved the Biden administration? We could also talk about how, you know, how does climate activism, how did it affect the Obama administration, for example?
Well, I mean, I would actually say that, the Biden administration is a big improvement over the Obama administration, both of them, for sure. And I mean, I think that, you know, Biden, in some ways, the way that Biden won the 2020 election was by taking on a progressive climate policy that was developed by Inslee and, you know, expanded with Elizabeth Warren and, you know, and Bernie Sanders. So what we saw was that he adopted this platform. He was successful with it. He was able to earn, you know, win over young people. And I had actually been studying at the time when the campaign was taking place, I was studying youth climate movement for a big project there. And I actually ended up surveying a number of young people who were active in the climate movement at the time. And I was curious to see what was going to happen when Biden was named as the nominee rather than, you know, Warren and Sanders were the top two because Inslee came out of the campaign early, but they were the top two when I had been surveying because I had asked people who they were supporting in the election, right? They were by far the ones that were getting the most support from climate activists, at least young people, because those are people who I was surveying. And then when Biden became the nominee, I was curious about what was going to happen. And I surveyed them after Biden took on the climate platform that had been developed by these other folks running for office, and they all got behind him. And I had evidence of it, and so I had written some things about that. With regard to Biden, you know, so Biden's, you know, administration has been very pro doing, you know, climate action. I mean, in a lot of ways, if what had happened during the Biden administration had happened during the Obama administration, I think there would have been a lot of cause to celebrate because it was earlier days. I mean, but we're still seeing tons and tons of fossil fuel extraction. We're the number one oil and natural gas exporter in the world. So, you know, and that's not changing under Biden, right? We have this pause, which is very symbolic. We see the Secretary of the Department of Energy making it very clear that it's temporary. We saw an announcement around the American Climate Corps, which I happen to, I've been studying the different Federal Service Corps programs that have been working on climate since the administration began in 2020 or 2021. And, you know, the American Climate Corps sounds like a great idea, but it's basically just a big rebranding effort. There are only 80 new jobs that are going to be existing through the American Climate Corps, at least this summer, to start with. So in a lot of ways, what we're seeing is a lot of signaling of support and response to the climate movement, but not a lot of actual action that will have long-term effects.
Do you think that's caused a rift with, like, the green groups or the climate movement and the Biden administration?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I talk about it in the book. I mean, what we basically see is that the big green groups came out and supported the Biden administration ridiculously early. Mm-hmm. And we had other groups, you know, many of them youth-led and many of them were part of this radical flank out in the streets protesting when that happened right here in Washington, D.C., you know? Mm-hmm. So ever since then, there's been a clear rift. But anyway, so at this point, with regard to the election, I think that there are some real challenges to the Biden administration around climate, particularly because a lot of climate voters are not sure how much he's really doing enough. And even though many of them, at least those of us who remember the 2000 election, are thinking very, you know, are likely to hold our noses and vote, we're not going to necessarily campaign. And if you're not going to campaign, the people who are unlikely voters may very well stay home. And if they stay home, Donald Trump will win the election. In addition to that, we have young voters, youth climate activists, many of whom feel really burned because they thought that if they mobilized enough people on TikTok, they were going to win and stop the Willow Project. Mm-hmm. And they're still burned about that. And then you add Gaza to the mix. And I'll tell you, you know, doing my book tour, I did events in New York City and also Los Angeles, where I invited in youth climate leaders to come and join me for the conversation. Mm-hmm. And 50% of the youth climate leaders who I had with me publicly stated that they were telling their supporters not to vote, not to participate.
Right.
Because they could not support the Biden administration. And their message, and I'm making very clear here, their message was both candidates are the same, which is absolutely not true. And I made that clear, but nobody listened to me when I said it when we had our event. But we have a real problem here. I mean, and this may be a good transition into talking about what's going on with on campuses right now, because young people are not getting behind the Biden administration, and they need to, or else the Trump administration will be winning.
Yeah, and so that's my last question about what your thoughts are on the current movement. I actually think I saw a poll today that like 81% of those polled actually think that Biden is mishandling the, you know, what's going on in Israel and Gaza, but particularly thinking about campuses, like, you know, the climate groups, the climate movement has put a lot of effort into organizing on campus. We see a lot of resources that have gone into that. It's part of the sort of narrative. It's like, we're doing this for the kids, we're doing this for the future. Yet, you know, and I know lots of climate activists and climate youth who are, you know, at encampments all over the country right now. And so, you know, what are your thoughts on how this is going to play out? And there's also, I mean, this is a lesser argument we don't have to get into, but there's also like overlap between like environmental destruction and war and, you know, ecological destruction that's happening in Gaza. And so.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have one of my colleagues, Andrew Jorgensen, who we co-authored the original Anthroship paper to get today, wrote an amazing piece that was only published less than a year ago, specifically mapping out the carbon footprint of the military-industrial complex. And it's remarkable. And anybody who wants to think that you can be, you know, supporting climate action and not supporting stopping, you know, war period, full stop, you better read the paper because it's just mind blowing.
Despite Lockheed Martin going green, you know, lessening the carbon footprint.
Exactly. So anyway, with regard to what's going on campuses, I think it's a really interesting question about what's coming next. We see a really interesting variation in what's going on in different campuses and how the state is responding on different campuses and how that's leading to violence in some places and not in others. And what we're, you know, this whole thing started, I mean, well, the encampment started on campus. There was lots of dissatisfaction around the country and young people were very unhappy and disheartened about what was going on in Gaza and the way that the administration was handling it well before this. But what happened is that after Columbia University called the police on their encampment, which, you know, I taught at Columbia University for 10 years. And while I taught there, I was there during Occupy. I was there during numerous other, you know, campaigns, including an anti, you know, around sweatshop labor, around, you know, against economic globalization, neoliberalism. There were always, we didn't call them encampments, but there were always kids camped out on campus in the small amount of green space we had. And everybody just left them alone and they did their business and they protested and got, you know, and got the message out. And in this case, students did basically the same thing and riot police were called on them. And it sparked, so this kind of repression, which is super, super common and known to escalate violence and escalate activism, happened on Columbia's campus, and within like 48 hours we saw encampments across the country
and the world. What, and the world,
yeah, and around the world. Yeah, now they have them around the world. I mean, and we, this is classic tactical diffusion is what we call it in the social movements world. What we're seeing now that's really interesting but sad at the same time is that in different places universities are handling it different ways. Like here in Washington DC, the DC government refused to follow through on the request from GW, which is where the largest encampment was, to bring in the police. They said, we will absolutely not do that. They made a decision. The government stepped in and said, we won't let our, you know, police do this. We learned from the protests after George Floyd was murdered and others. We know how to, you know, we know how escalation works, and this will backfire, and this is a stupid idea, and we're not going to do it. And they haven't, and we have a big peaceful encampment at GW. All the other universities are there. I actually, one activist asked me if I would sign a book and donate it to take to the encampment. My book is at the encampment in the library, and, you know.
Nice.
And everything's going fine, although it's interesting because Republican leaders have now called on DC government to bring in the police, right, to clear the encampment. But it's really interesting how restraint is working very nicely, and so we're seeing peaceful protests play out. Not the same where there were counter protesters at UCLA, right?
Yeah.
Really stark contrast there. So how does that lead to, I mean, I'm thinking very seriously about writing a piece about how, you know, 2024, summer and fall 2024 is likely to be like, you know, a long, hot summer and fall of protests, right? It's going to be a hot summer. There's no question about that. We've got a lot of different things leading towards likely protests. And we know that whatever happens in the election, people are going to be unhappy with the outcome. So I think we all need to like buckle our seatbelts. And I really hope that everybody just remembers that, you know, if we think back to some of the most of the most effective movements in at least America's past, but also in most advanced industrialized nations' past, they were peaceful. And I think it's really important to try to lean into that and make sure that activists, when they are faced with repression, violent repression, and counter protests that are violent against them, they need to use that moment to draw, you know, to shine a light on what's happening so that the general public can learn about it and also can, you know, can spin sympathizers into activists in support and solidarity.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for saying that. I know we're probably at time, so I just want to thank you. Do you want to just tell us where we can find out about the book?
Sure. My name is Dana R. Fisher. Let's see, you can go to, and the book is Saving Ourselves from Climate Shocks to Climate Action. It's published by Columbia University Press. You can go to your local bookstore. If you go to the Columbia University Press website and use the code CUP20, you get 20% off.
Nice. And we'll also put that stuff in the show notes as well.
Outstanding.
Dana, thanks for joining me today. Folks, this is the Green Red Podcast. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Hit subscribe on YouTube. Subscribe to us on audio platforms. And then if you like us, go to greenredpodcast.org and hit the support button and make a donation or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And until we talk again, go out and misbehave and make trouble. And we'll talk to you all again real soon.